And as soon as the last of these people has left, we can ask how much electricity could be generated by burning all of the papers filed in the last case. Mr. Henry.
May it please the court. Christina Eilman was seriously injured at the hands of Marvin Powell, a private actor. Although Eilman's mother, Kathleen Payne, brought
What if she'd had a heart attack in the police station? Could the police have just turned her out into the parking lot and say, get lost?
I don't think so. I think we would have...
Why is this case any different?
This case...
Instead of having a heart attack, she has a manic episode.
Because the manic episode...
Which, of course, endangers her the same way a heart attack would if you're, one block from Taylor Holmes.
Because the manic episode began long before
she
came.
Yeah, look, if you have a heart attack, you have heart disease, and you have, premonitory symptoms, right? So she's sick. She gets sick at the airport. She gets sick at the airport. She's actually having heart symptoms, but the police don't understand, and they think she's, disrupting the peace, disorderly conduct. So they take her to the police station. There she has the full-fledged heart attack. And they say, go outside. Maybe you'll find a cab or something. Take you to hospital.
Yes.
They don't give her enough money for the cab. Let's add that to the equation.
The police did not let her out. The police, in fact, kept her to process her arrest. Her condition preexisted the arrest.
Yeah, but that's true with the heart. The heart disease preexists the heart attack, right?
Well, had she had heart disease and expressed problems with her heart that would...
What do you mean expressed problems with the heart? She has a heart attack.
Well, if she has a heart attack.
She doesn't express a problem, say, I'm having a heart attack. She has a heart attack.
If she has a heart attack, then obviously she's needs...
Well, what's the difference between having a heart attack and being a lunatic and having a psychotic episode?
Well, her condition preexisted her coming in.
That's true with a heart disease, for goodness sakes.
Well, heart disease, yes, but she had the manic episode.
Well, suppose this, my hypothetical case, she has a heart attack. In the police station, and a heart attack in the airport. And the airport people don't understand what's going on, and they call the police. They think maybe she's faking or she wants to get a free ticket. Goodness knows what goes on in airports. So the police arrest her, take her to the police station, her heart attack is continuing. And then they say, well, you just have a heart attack. You haven't committed a crime, so we're putting you out into our parking lot, and you can walk to 51st Street.
Well, there's no
so
indication.
What is the situation? So would you agree in that case that they'd have a constitutional duty to, call an ambulance?
Well, under your hypothetical, I'm
asking you whether you agree with my suggestion that in my hypothetical case, they do have a constitutional duty to call an ambulance.
I think during the court, if she were arrested...
Why don't you say yes?
Or no?
I think you'll have to say
yes. I want to make sure I'm clear on the facts that I'm saying yes to.
So you want to waste your time and have me repeat what I just told you, okay?
Yes.
She has a heart attack in the airport. Her symptoms are misunderstood by the airport officials. Call the police. She's taken to a police station. She's got the heart attack. They realize she has a heart attack, not guilty of disorderly conduct. So he says, well, fine, you haven't committed a crime. We're releasing you, and you go out into the, you go out to 51st Street, and maybe you can, if you live that long, maybe you'll be able to get a taxi, take you to a hospital.
No, I think she was in immediate danger. Yes, the answer is...
Answer my question?
The answer to your question is yes, we would have
Fine.
A constitutional duty to take her to the hospital.
And how is this case different?
This case is different because she was not in immediate danger of death. She was Her condition
she's
did not...
She's one block from Taylor Holmes. You have a lunatic woman wandering, scantily clad at night, wandering around in Taylor Holmes, which I'm told has 15 times the sexual assault incidents as the city average, or as the area around O'Hare.
When she was freed, after processing her arrest, as is in the normal course, on an I bond, she was released as the Constitution, as the Fourth Amendment would require.
Well, I don't see how that's different from my heart attack case.
Well, she had the freedom at that point.
So does the heart attack person. She's free. She just has a heart attack.
Yes.
This person is free, but she's a lunatic. So what's the difference?
The difference
unless
is...
Unless you don't recognize mental disease as disease.
Well...
Maybe you think it's just eccentricity.
No, I think that I do recognize mental disease.
Well, you think she has mental disease?
Yes, I certainly do think that she had
and
mental...
And do you think that she showed signs of mental disease while
absolutely
in captivity there?
No question about it. There's no question about it. She had a severe mental impairment, no question about it. She was arrested for a crime that she committed, not just symptoms of a disease. She actually committed a crime that by clear disorderly conduct and interfering with the lives of other people, she was arrested. She was taken to the...
Not clear she could be convicted, right?
I don't know whether she would be convicted or not. I don't
think
charges
were
pursued.
Right, well, you said she committed a crime.
But there was certainly probable...
You said she committed a crime.
She certainly... There was certainly...
To commit a crime, you have to be a criminal.
There was probable cause to believe
yes,
that she committed
it,
a crime.
Yes, but in my hypothetical, these symptoms gave probable cause to arrest this person. I mean, a lot of illness can give the impression that people are disorderly, what have you.
Correct. There was probable cause, and she was arrested.
I mean, my hypothetical, what if she's running around, she's screaming, I have a heart attack, and they say, this is a lunatic, causing a disturbance, take her away.
Well, in that situation, I think there's a question that the officers would have about whether or not she was believable when she expressed problems about concerning her health. Here, there was no doubt that she had a mental impairment. There was no doubt that she had a mental impairment, but there was also no doubt that there was probable cause to believe that she committed a crime. During the course of her incarceration, her condition did not deteriorate.
Yeah, but she's diagnosed by lay people. They say this person is manic depressive, right? They know it's obvious what she has. So then they put her out. I mean, what if there was a big hole in the parking lot? So and it's not shielded and it's night and so on. They know it's there. But they say, okay, just walk to 51st Street. But they don't warn her about the hole and she falls in and breaks a leg. Would they be liable?
She doesn't see it or it's not
she
obvious?
She doesn't see it. It's dark. It's a hole in the ground.
I don't think she'd be liable under the Constitution. She might be liable under state law.
I don't agree. Why isn't that the Bowers case? Bowers versus DeVito?
Yes.
Cited. Well, we used that. We gave the hypothetical of a snake pit. The police... The police throw somebody into a snake pit. The snakes bite the person. And the police say, well, look, sue the snakes. They're the ones who did the harm. And we said that, if you create this, if you have someone in custody and create a dangerous situation, you're liable. And why wouldn't that be
yes.
the same with a hole in the ground?
We don't have that situation. When
what about the hole?
We have a worse situation.
No. What about the hole?
To be honest.
What about the hole in the ground?
If she had fallen into a hole in the ground and there was not adequate notice in the parking lot for people to see the hole in the ground,
right.
then perhaps we might
what
well...
You, why,
we
perhaps,
might
why are you hedging with perhaps? What's
well,
your doubt?
In this situation, because there's a question of freedom here. When she was released...
I'm talking about my hypothetical case. The
right.
hole in the ground which cannot be seen because
right.
it's dark and there's no warning. And you say perhaps there would be liability, and I wonder why you're hedging what your doubts are.
Because there are a million circumstances that could bear upon whether she could have seen the hole, couldn't see the hole.
I just told you she can't see the hole.
All right. In that situation, not having informed her of the hole in the ground.
That's what I told. Why do you repeat what I say? You're just using up your time.
Yes, that would that might well be a constitutional violation.
What do you mean that might well be? Why don't you say it is?
All right, okay, it's a constitutional violation.
Could I just ask you what I think is the bottom line question here? If the police dropped off an African American 21-year-old man in the middle of a Ku Klux rally, would it really matter that they didn't constrict his access to self-help?
I would say that the person's access to self-help was constricted by placing him in, while in custody, placing him in a situation that was dangerous.
Let me alter Judge Rose's question slightly. Suppose that when they let her out in the parking lot, there's a Ku Klux Klan march on 51st Street. And they know it. You know, Constitution, free speech, they're marching along, and they let her out, knowing that she's going to walk up out of the parking lot. Well, the parking lot is on 51st, or she's going to walk on to 51st, and she's going to be in the middle of a Ku Klux Klan rally. So would that change your answer to Judge Rovner?
Well, I assume that since she was a white woman,
and this and that, and the other.
Well,
why
she was a white woman.
That's what she said. Why do you keep repeating what we say? Huh?
Well, the hypothetical.
Waste your time.
I understood the hypothetical to be black young men being placed in a Ku Klux Klan rally.
No. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, black. Right. Okay. Sorry.
All right. She was a white woman.
Oh, please. I'm asking you about Judge Rovner's case. If the Ku Klux Klan are marching down 51st Street at night with their torches and their white costumes and so on, and they had let her out, knowing about the Ku Klux Klan, knowing that if she walked up to 51st Street, she would be in the middle of the...
That would be a constitutional violation.
That would be.
That would constrict her avenues of self-help. She would have...
Wait a second. But she could walk the other way on... No. Why do you say that?
Well,
because she can walk down what's the street that borders on? Well, there is a I don't see it listed on my map.
On the north side.
There is a street that runs north to south.
Wentworth runs along the north south border.
So if she walked down there, she'd miss the hypothetical rally.
Had she been free to walk down? Had the police
officers?
Well,
that's another exit from the parking lot.
If the police officers had left black young men on Wentworth away from the Ku Klux Klan rally, then the officers would not be constitutionally liable.
No, I'm not talking about a case where the police say, don't go to 51st Street, go to Wentworth. It's safe on Wentworth. You're black, you'll be safe on Wentworth. I'm saying they just let her out in the parking lot. There are two exits. She can go to 51st, she can go to Wentworth. They don't tell her about the 51st Street. They don't tell her about either one. They don't warn her. But on your, avenues of escape left open, wouldn't you have to answer Judge Rovner differently? Wouldn't you have to say there was no violation because there was another place she could have walked?
I understood Judge Rovner's question to be dropped her right in the middle of the Ku Klux Klan rally. If that's the case, that would be a constitutional violation.
I altered it. Now there's a march on one street. Another street, accessible from the police station, is safe. So in your view, there wouldn't be a violation. Is that correct? Because there's an avenue of escape?
In my view, there wouldn't be a violation because there is an avenue of escape. And
these latest questions from Judge Posner and Rovner are really questions that don't have anything to do with Eilman's mental disease. And they're asking about a variety of problems that's worried me since I started reading these briefs, which is, what are the duties of the police if they arrest somebody in a safe place, O'Hare Airport, for example, transport that person to a dangerous place, the Robert Taylor Homes, your local snake pit, whatever, and then release the person in the dangerous place and say, you're free now. And part of the marginal danger of moving somebody from O'Hare to the Robert Taylor Homes comes to pass. It doesn't one say that the police are liable for that increment of danger? Right? They may not have any duty to provide mental health care, but what they've done is increase the danger by the movement and allowing the release following the movement. Right? So what are the obligations of police who arrest somebody in a safe place and release her in a dangerous place?
If I understood your hypothetical, it is actually release her in the Robert Taylor Homes, not release her from a police station that's in the Robert Taylor Homes.
He didn't ask you. He didn't give you a hypothetical case. He asked you a general question.
Well, the police office, the police station is safe.
I motivated my question by talking about O'Hare to the Robert Taylor Homes, but I asked you a general question, which is, what are the obligations of police who move somebody from a safe place, a place where the arrest occurs, to a more dangerous place? In your view, is it ever the obligation of the police to put the person back in the safe place?
Well, or a safe place, yes. If a person is transferred to an unsafe place, then yes, there would be a constitutional violation.
What happened here? This person was arrested in a safe place, moved to an unsafe place, and released. And it turns out because of her mental condition, she was in no position to escape the dangers of the unsafe place. But the big thing that happened was the movement to an unsafe place.
Well, I take issue with the movement to the unsafe place. She was transferred to a police station, which is a safe place.
For God's sakes, this woman is from California. I mean, you know, she's not even someone who knows Chicago. And they knew that she was from California.
She was... the police station is a safe place. That's not even their claim.
That's like saying a boat is a safe place, but the ocean surrounding it isn't, right?
So the police could have had her walk the plank on a police boat, right? You're arrested, you're taken out to a police boat, they say you're free now, and push her overboard.
Well, I think it's different. There's a building, there's no suggestion at all that she would have been prohibited from making private arrangements to be transferred from that police station to
a
safe place.
She's a lunatic, however.
Yes, she is.
She's in no position to do that, right? I'm not really asking for quibbles about whether it could have been safer for her had she had her wits about her. I'm just trying to pursue the general question. What happens when the police move someone from a safe to an unsafe place? Now, you started out by saying, yeah, that can potentially create a problem, that increment of danger, which is introduced by the movement. Does the city do anything to deal with that increment of danger? Because the thing that struck me about this case is that every time she was moved, first she's arrested and taken to police station 1, then she's moved to police station 2. Every time she moves, it's more dangerous rather than safer. And then she's let out in the dangerous place.
Yes, and the...
How does Chicago deal with that kind of problem?
There's nothing in the record to indicate what policies there are. But there's no evidence in the record that she would have been prohibited...
Are there published policies?
I'm not aware of any published policy. But there's no evidence in the record to indicate that she would not have been allowed to remain in the station long enough to make private arrangements. It's true that she has...
I bet you're back.
It's true that...
They bonded her out.
What if she were a child?
It's true...
If she were a child, would that make any difference?
As we read the case law...
There'd be no difference.
That's right. As we read the case law, the person's...
What case law are you reading?
As we read the Cheney... which involved a young child, the fact that the child was free was actually free and not in custody meant that the state could not be liable for the injuries that occurred to him. We see no indication in the case law that the particular circumstances, the particular deficiencies in the person's ability to act like age or like mental impairment or sex has anything to do with the Constitution. The Constitution protects again, ensures freedom. And when
the difference is that in DeShaney, the question is, what obligations have child custody authorities to monitor children and so on? These are not people who are. DeShaney was not in state, was not in a, you know, in a state facility. Obviously, that's the problem, and the court doesn't want to get into the business of telling the states how much resources they have to allocate to protecting people from private dangers. That's the DeShaney principle. This case is about someone in custody. And the question is, can they simply expel the person from custody into a, you know, extremely dangerous surrounding made more dangerous by her mental problem?
She was fully processed. She was released from custody on an I bond after she signed it.
They released her without any directions, without any information as how to safely find transportation out of the area. They pointed the way to the Robert Taylor homes. They released her at night. Her race, her mental state, made her a predictable target. The transportation to that area and the release at night affirmatively placed her in a position of danger she would not otherwise have faced. It is egregious.
She was released from custody. She was asked whether she wanted to make telephone calls.
Yeah, she's crazy,
in the middle of a psychotic break, for God's sakes.
But the Constitution doesn't recognize those aspects of her situation. The Constitution ensures that persons are free. They don't ensure that people who have problems from...
See, you're back to the fact that a movement had occurred. You would be, I think, on pretty good ground had the police driven her back to O'Hare and released her in the main terminal at O'Hare and said, you'd better call your mother and make sure your mother wires you the funds for a ticket. But that's not what they did. That's the problem here.
The police station, again, was safe. We cannot, the city could not, as a practical matter, transfer arrestees from stations that are in unsafe areas to safe areas.
You can't call an ambulance?
Excuse me?
You can't call an ambulance?
Well, we asked her, do you want to make a telephone call?
I asked a different question. Could they call an ambulance?
Yes, but the fact that they didn't call the ambulance does not render them constitutionally liable. She could have chosen to get in the ambulance or not. They asked her whether she wanted to make a telephone call. She didn't.
Thank you, Mr. Henry. Thank you. Mr. Singer.
Jeffrey Singer on behalf of Christina Eilman. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time going over the same things we addressed in the brief, but in the reply brief of the defendants, they made reference.
I'm interested in how far your argument goes. Suppose somebody sitting on the benches here has a psychotic episode and begins screaming in court.
Happens occasionally.
Happens even to lawyers.
Happens to judges.
We press a button and call the marshals. And the marshals take her down to the first floor and release her. Have we violated the Constitution?
No, because you're attempting to provide her with assistance. She's in a serious medical need.
No, we've done what the police did here after a fashion. That is, we have not called an ambulance. We have not taken her to a hospital. We have taken her outside the building and said, you're free to go, but you're not entitled to scream in the courthouse during an oral argument. Now, is there a constitutional duty to provide health care, mental health care, just because a physical problem occurs inside a governmental building? That's the question I'm asking.
the individual that you described in the hypothetical is not in custody. And there's a distinction. Not in custody is not under arrest. As
well, why on your view does anything turn on custody? Right. What the police did wrong, as you say, is they ended the custody. They actually let her go. Her psychotic episode didn't happen while she was in custody. It was continuing while she was in custody. I mean, suppose instead of being psychotic, she had been Joshua DeShaney, who was 6 years old, perfectly healthy, but also perfectly helpless.
The distinction is whether it's a
right. The police find Joshua DeShaney wandering around at O'Hare, apparently lost. They don't arrest him. There's no crime to being lost. But they pick him up, take him to a police station, and then, of course, release him. Right? Nothing. He hadn't been arrested. But you would say if they picked up Joshua DeShaney at O'Hare and released him next to the Robert Taylor Holmes, and he were then injured, you would say the government was liable. And it wasn't because of any arrest, because in my hypothetical, he's never arrested. So what's the real principle here? Is it that there's a duty to provide health care to anybody who has a health problem on governmental premises, or is it that the problem here is the movement from a safe place to an unsafe place? Or maybe there's some other problem.
Well, the movement is essentially, especially when in this instance, the hypothetical person, Joshua DeShaney, is a child and lacks capacity and likely has some level of impaired judgment due to his youth. Or Christina Eilman, who in this instance had a lack
Could
of capacity.
You just
you're not
bit
dealing
louder.
With my question. What is the real problem? Is it something peculiar to arrest? I think not, because the way you're going to answer, the way you surely think about my Joshua DeShaney hypothetical, nothing turned on his fact that he wasn't arrested. Is it the movement to an unsafe place? Or are you making the broad argument that if somebody has, say, if a member of the audience here has a heart attack, and we fail to provide mental health care, we are personally liable for that? Is that what you're arguing?
The movement to an unsafe place is the predominant argument we are making here. The distinction is whether or not there's a constitutional violation by a failure to provide medical assistance to someone here in the back of the courtroom that may require some kind of assistance. Is that tort law? Or is that a constitutional violation? And I may be seemingly giving the...
Tort law is perfectly straightforward. There's never any duty to be a good Samaritan. If somebody has a heart attack in the back room and we in the back row and we just say, I'm sorry you brought your bad heart with you, right? We might be liable if one of us rushed down and attempted to provide medical care and botched the job, right? But the standby principle of tort law is that if you just don't attempt to help a person in distress, there's no liability. And I don't see why that would be any different if the distress manifests itself in a governmental office rather than a private office.
The distinction relates to different areas of the law. One is local tort law as opposed to what the Constitution requires. We submit here with respect to Ms. Allen, the Constitution required the police to provide her with access to medical care because she had a serious medical condition that was readily obvious not to police officers based on what's of record, but to lay people who are not specially trained in psychiatry and diagnostics. So we believe a constitutional violation occurs here, not ordinary tort law, because under DeShaney and its progeny, if you provide that person with, place that person in a position of greater danger, especially when you know, as the record recognizes here, that Ms. Almond was having a severe psychiatric episode, glaringly obvious to lay people, police and non-lay people. By placing her in that state-created danger environment, we know reliably, foreseeably, what's going to happen. And the record here shows clear evidence that the neighborhood where she was released...
You were here for the last argument, I assume. You say we know what's going to happen. What percentage of the people released at that police station are molested before they leave the area?
Well, we do know from Chicago police crime data that if we compare the environment of where Ms. Almond
is... It's a much more dangerous area. The risks are much greater. But you don't want to say it's more likely than not that somebody released from that police station will be the victim of a crime before he clears the neighborhood.
The evidence of trial will show that this person...
Well, it depends who the person is.
Right.
Exactly.
I'm sorry.
It's what
right.
you were just
yeah.
saying.
Yes. I mean, the evidence of record here to defeat summary judgment is, was the environment where this grossly impaired woman was released made it more foreseeable that she, per se, was more at risk? Now, we know from Chicago police crime data that the ordinary citizen who was in that environment where she was released had a 15 times greater likelihood of being a victim of criminal sexual assault, aggravated battery, and aggravated assault. That's not impaired
people. I can understand. The base likelihood is very low. 15 times a low likelihood is still low, but it's 15 times higher. By the way, what would have happened in your view if she'd been released, managed to get on a bus, leave the area, go back to the airport and leave? Could she recover damages for the marginal risk?
Well, there has to be some kind of articulated constitutional injury or damage here. And that's, based on your hypothetical, it's very difficult for me to say yes or no, per se. But what I can say, based on what's of record here, that non-emotionally impaired people in that neighborhood compared to where she was first arrested, which was at Midway Airport, the CTA station, is 15 times higher. Now, the jury can well imagine that the level of foreseeability of her becoming a sexual assault victim could be markedly higher because of her impairment. That's why we take issue with the defendant's contention that an essential element of proof here is the access to self-help, that Ms. Eilman must have established that she exhausted all efforts of self-help. Not only is that contrary to the law in the circuit under Montfields versus Taylor, we know from the record here that Ms. Ahmed lacked the capacity. She truly was thrown in the snake pit. She was the children, like in White versus Rochford, who was on the Chicago Skyway, an old case back from the late 70s. She lacked the capacity to make those kinds of judgments. Her impairment was so severe. I'd like to highlight one case that we set out in our brief called Davis versus Jones, which Mr. Justice Easterbrook was the author of that opinion. And this relates to the issue, does the Fourth Amendment apply here? Is there clearly established law here under the to defeat the qualified immunity doctrine? That case did not specially address objective reasonableness. However, because the court did not find a serious medical condition, but in Davis versus Jones, this court stated that it has been a tireless effort by this court to set objective standards for police conduct. And in that case, objective reasonableness.
Could you clarify for me, there's the question whether her property, which included prescription drugs, was returned to her. I couldn't figure out what the status of that was. Was it returned, or do we not know? Or did these include antipsychotic drugs?
Well, what we do know from police investigation photographs that there was, I believe, one medicine bottle found at the crime scene, and we do not believe that there was antipsychotic drugs. There was other prescription medication. Uh-huh. The reason why the medication is relevant, though, here, is that when the police first brought her to the first police station, prescription bottles were found in her luggage. She had, like, a soft bag, which, by the way, was never transported to the second police station. They never brought that over there. So upon her release, she didn't have any of her personal effects except what was...
Well, she had sweatpants and $7.
Sweatpants and $7 at minimum. And we do know from the crime scene photographs I just mentioned a few moments ago, there was one medicine bottle that was that I recall from the photographs that was there, to be forthright and responsive to your question. So there is some issue with respect to what exactly she was released. We know she had $7. We do
but
know
there's
she had
no
a
reason to think this was antipsychotic medicine. You say the one at the crime was not, but
we do know that
we
she
don't
was,
know about the others. Or?
We do know it in the past she had been prescribed medication.
But we don't know whether she had it with her. Well, actually, she probably wouldn't have taken it anyway, since she was in her
not
condition.
Not taking her medication, in part because of the nature of the underlying condition.
Right.
So, but again, to reference the primary arguments that the defendants make, the right, the obligation to provide to rule out access to self-help, we believe, is not only not the law in this circuit, but also importantly that the facts of record show that Ms. Ahmed did not have the capacity to make those kinds of judgments of calling for help, such as calling her parents when she was first released from custody, which she did not do, by walking around in wearing fairly scantily clothes in the neighborhood, a neighborhood she was totally unfamiliar, where people in the community were telling her it was unsafe for her to be there, that she should leave. And her, the extent of her impaired judgment calls out from this record that shows that district court did not abuse her discretion in assessing that there was a question of material fact here. So unless the court has any other questions, I will end my argument. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.